Good morning. I'd like to continue our look at the life of David. We are in the second book of Samuel and the 18th chapter. And we have here something of a finale. There are two kings in Israel. Absalom, a usurping prince, and David, a somewhat chastened older man. And in chapter 18, we have the battle between the two. Who will be king of Israel? Whose side will be vindicated? How will the providence of God be played? It begins in verse 1 of chapter 18. And David numbered the people who were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Then David sent out one third of the people under the hand of Joab, one third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one third under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you myself. But the people answered, You shall not go out, for if we flee away, they will not care about us, nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us now, for you are now more help to us in the city. Notice here that the minority of people who have remained faithful to David during this rebellion have a real love for him. They don't want him to come and fight with them, or to lead them, to be some kind of figurehead. Love him though they do, rather they would prefer that he were safe in the nearby city, and that he let them do the fighting. I'm not sure that Absalom, though he's popular and he's admired, I'm not sure there is that same level of affection among Israel, which is going out to fight him, and the people who have remained faithful to David. Then the king said to them in verse 4, Whatever seems best to you, I will do. There is, I think, a degree of humility here in David. I do not think for any moment he lacks courage. David is a great man, and he does have a number of faults, but cowardice is not one of them. And I think here that a humbler King David is prepared to observe the wishes of his people instead of to rule them and overrule them. The Lord often allows us to go through difficult times, through periods which make us deeply uncomfortable. And yet we always come out better. And I wonder if there is a humility now in the great King David. He's had to vacate his throne and his capital. And I wonder if he has also had to vacate his pride. The pride which allowed him to summon Bathsheba and bump off her husband. That pride, I think, is gone. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. Now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. Now, is that a strange thing to say? Absalom is a rebel prince. He has tried to kill David. He has taken his concubines. He has occupied his rooms. He has taken his furniture. Where is the gratitude? Where is the respect? Where is the honouring of a father from a young man? Well, it has been nowhere to be seen. And yet there is a love in David for Absalom that is clearly not reciprocated. I'm mindful of Psalm 103, a psalm of David. Verse 13 reads, As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. Absalom has done nothing to warrant this compassion, this unfailing love, this unreciprocated love, honour, fascination. And we have here, I think, a picture of Christ and the sinner. Christ had compassion and love and charity towards us while we ignored him and hated him. Preachers will often tell us that there are many Greek words for love, the chief of which is agape, a word used in the New Testament, a word for love, the quintessential, purest form of love, a love which loves without being loved back. Some Greek philosophers wondered whether it really existed, and yet that is the love we read of in the 3rd of John, that God so loved, agaped the world. He gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish but have eternal life. God has a love for the sinner, which is deep and passionate, even though that love may not be returned. And David commands his 3 captain generals, deal gently with the young man Absalom. He calls him a young man. He doesn't call him the rebel or the thief or the traitor. He is the young man. He loves that man. And he says, be gentle with him for my sake. For his sake, he ought to die. But for David's sake, show him mercy. And it's wonderful to think that we Christians have been and will be shown mercy, not for our own sakes, for we do not deserve it, but for the sake of Christ, who upon the cross said, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. In verse 6, we get the actual battle. Now, the writer is somewhat sparing in detail when it comes to this battle. Now, I like a good battle description as much as the next man, but we don't really get it. It says, the people went out into the field of battle against Israel. Notice again, the opponents, the people of Absalom are called Israel. Those fighting for David are called the people. Now, why is that? I think there are 2 points we might make here. Israel is not just a nation. Israel are those who believe in and obey God. And so I wonder if there's a little irony that those who have set themselves up against the God of Israel, fighting the true King of Israel, are here ironically called Israel. The other explanation might be that the people, perhaps the common people who are with David, are a minority. They might be the poorest. You might recall when he was a young man and he went and hid in the caves from Saul, that the rough people, the runaways, the criminals went to help him, a right rough and ready band they were. I wonder if there is an element of that here. Whereas those who are hovering around Absalom, the people who flocked to the palace when David left, the posh people, the clever people, the smartly dressed people, the well-clad people, it might be that the word Israel sums them up. They are the majority. They are the most impressive members of the citizenry. Don't ever think that because you're not in a majority, you're in the wrong. The Christian has in nearly all times and all places been in the minority. The world around them stands for things which are contrary to the gospel. They may claim to be Israel, but only those who are on the side of the king can truly claim to be Israel. We're told in verse 7, the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. Again, the detail is rather short. What we know is that the people, those who are fighting for David, prevail, and those who rallied around the false king's standard have been defeated, and 20,000 have died. Now, when Absalom was attempting to ingratiate himself with the people, making them promises and assuring them how fair they would be, I don't think he promised 20,000 deaths, and yet that is what he has delivered. He promised fairness, he promised life, he promised equity. In fact, he delivers death. And there is a challenging thought, if ever we had one. Those who fought for David, God's anointed king, there may well, of course, been casualties on his side, and yet, by and large, it's they who live, not the greater army. We're told the battle took place in the woods of Ephraim, and almost certainly the land there was thick forest. Now, we in England are not used to forest. We have a few areas that call themselves forest, and we have some woodland, but we don't have large tracts of land covered with scrub, thick vegetation, with trees. And yet that is where the battle took place. And I wonder if David, clever strategist and general that he was, arranged for the battle to take place there by fighting in complicated terrain. The smaller army doesn't lose so much. The larger army may well lose its advantage, which appears to have been the case here. And then there is a remarkable comment in verse 8. The battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. In other words, the fighting took place in this woodland, this dense forest, and in fact the physical terrain was responsible for killing more than the actual battle, tripping over logs, running into trees, falling into a hole or a crevice, did more harm to Absalom's army than the people fighting for David. And again, I see here the very providence of God. People will often look at chapters like this and say, well, where is the Lord? What is he doing? He's being rather passive. In fact, I would suggest the Lord killed more enemy soldiers in this chapter than David manages himself. Let me read verse 9. Then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth. He was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the mule which was under him went on. In one sense, we have here a rather comical scene. Now, a mule is not the kind of creature upon which you would ride if you're going into battle. He's not on a horse. Absalom, I think, is quite happy for his men to fight for him. David, on the other hand, is also not fighting, but he wanted to fight, but his men wanted to save him. I suspect Absalom is riding a mule because it's more comfortable, perhaps more regal. It's certainly not the mode of transport chosen by a warrior. And he comes across some of David's men, and presumably skedaddles, and yet he gets caught up in the boughs of a tree. And he's left hanging while the mule keeps on going. It's rather comical, and yet it's also rather tragic. Look at the expression in verse 9. He was left hanging between heaven and earth. Now, I think that really is a description of a man caught in a tree branch. It might be that there is a V-shaped branch where one branch breaks off into two and it's caught him by the neck. Doubtless he is injured. Or it might be that his thick mane of hair has become entangled and he's being held by the hair, which I imagine is also rather painful. You might recall in chapter 14, verse 26, the hair, rather luxuriant coiffure, of Absalom was a source of pride, we're told. And when he cut the hair of his head, at the end of every year, he cut it because it was heavy on him. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels, according to the king's standard. Here is a man who grows his hair all year, and then cuts it, and then goes to the trouble of weighing it. Now, we know he's a very handsome man. He's a very athletic man, and doubtless a few of the ladies would like to keep a locket or two of what he left behind. And it's ironic that the source of his pride, a symbol of his beauty, of his prowess, is in fact his downfall. Had he had a rather more modest hairstyle, what happens in verse 9 may not have happened, or he may have been able to break free. Either way, he's hanging from a thick bough. But what of that comment, left hanging between heaven and earth? Yes, I think it's a physical description of where Absalom is at that particular time. And yet I think there is some spiritual truth in there as well. You see, Absalom is about to die. He comes to a sticky end in just a few verses' time. He's hanging between heaven and earth. I wonder if really that can be said of all of us. No man knows the day or the hour of his own death. I don't know when I'm going to die. You don't know when you're going to die. You might have an idea. If you're aged 105, you might have a better idea than me. But every one of us is hanging between earth and eternity. And at any moment that silver thread might break. We must each one of us prepare for eternity. There is a heaven to be gained and a hell to be shunned. And there are many people in Britain today who simply do not care about eternity. They assume that death is the end. Once you're dead, they'll tell you. But what if that's not right? What if when we die, it is merely a separation of two of our constituent parts? The soul separates from the body. The body remains on the earth, decomposing. But the soul or spirit goes into eternity. To hell or to heaven? Well, if I thought that a very distinct possibility, I would want to do everything I could to make sure I ended up in heaven and not in the pit. You know, you can know where you're going when you die. You can know and you can have an assurance by trusting Christ. By believing that when he hung upon that cross, he was making a payment for our sin. He was buying our forgiveness. He was assuring our salvation. He was providing for our redemption. By believing that and applying it to your own heart. Friends, you've already crossed over from death to life. Each one of us, like Absalom, hangs in the tree between eternity and earth. The source of our pride is often what keeps us there hanging. And there he is, doubtless injured, perhaps somewhat bloodied, but he's alive. Now a certain man in verse 10 saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. Now Joab responds by rebuking him. You just saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. Now, the shekels of silver, we understand. Why offer to give him a belt? Well, it might be more like a girdle. I imagine that officers in the Israelite army at this time are perhaps distinguished by the belt they wear. If you want a modern illustration, think of karate. Your skill in karate is acknowledged in the colour of your belt. If you're a brown belt, you're pretty good. If you're a black belt, you're even better. I wonder if Joab is telling this anonymous man, look, if you'd have killed him, I'd have given you a handsome tip and I would have rewarded you. And yet this anonymous man is clearly somebody of honour. The man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. Now notice he calls him the king's son. In other words, he would not kill Absalom for David's sake. Yes, Absalom deserves to die. He is a rebel. But for David's sake, he would not lay a finger upon him. And he gives the reason why. For in our hearing, the king commanded you, and Abishai, and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Now, in fact, that is a slightly different wording to what we had earlier in the chapter. It's rather more emphatic. Whether the man is being defensive because he's being accused of being slovenly by his commanding officer, or whether he quite rightly interprets David's determination that Absalom should live, I do not know. He says, otherwise I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. This anonymous man is clever in a number of ways. Not only is he faithful to David, but he also knows that Joab, if the wind was blowing in a different direction, would be the first to condemn him before David, if he thought it expedient. And Joab dismisses him in verse 14. I cannot linger with you. And off he goes. Well, the anonymous man in verse 10, who speaks in verse 11 and 12, is a man of honour, a man who would save the rebel prince for the sake of his loving father. And yet he doesn't receive the silver or his girdle, his belt. He is dismissed. Do we come across him again? I do not know. Does he get his promotion in the future? I do not know that either. But I do know that perhaps doing the right thing is the right thing to do, even when it costs us promotion and money. Do the right thing for the sake of Christ, even if it's costly here on earth. I can assure you, he can more than recompense in eternity. Joab does what the anonymous man refuses to do. He took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And although that sounds pretty fatal to me, clearly he was still alive, because in verse 15, 10 young men who looked after Joab's armour surround Absalom, struck him and kill him. Does he deserve to die? Yes. The wages of sin are death. He has cursed his father. He deserves to die. He has tried to kill his father. He deserves to die. He has lost a battle. He deserves to die. Was Joab right to kill him? Yes and no. Perhaps it was providence that it was Joab who first heard the news of Absalom's hanging from the tree. And yet at the same time, he has disobeyed the king. Is Joab rather like a rebel as well as Absalom? I wonder if Joab, for his own reasons, decided to kill Absalom. He wanted stability in the kingdom, and the death of Absalom would surely procure that. Joab has had previous dealings with Absalom. Perhaps he blamed himself that by orchestrating his return from exile, he perhaps was in some way responsible for the current rebellion. I do not know. And yet I don't think anyone can question the justice of Absalom's death. Joab in verse 16 blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. Perhaps there is a degree of mercy in him somewhere. They took Absalom and cast him in a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Well, they've buried him in the woodland and they've heaped stones upon it. And I wonder if there is something rather symbolic here. I wonder if this burial is somehow linked to stoning, a fairly unpleasant method of executing someone. In Deuteronomy 21, verses 20 to 21, stoning is the legal penalty due to a rebel son. By burying him under a pile of stones, He's buried, as it were, as the rebel son. In Joshua 7 and 8, a heap of stones was often piled to show someone that the buried was a criminal or an enemy. Again, in Joshua, Achan, when he was stoned to death for sacrilege, is buried under a large pile of stones. The king of Ai, also in Joshua, is thrown into a pit and covered with a large pile of stones. And in chapter 10 of Joshua, five enemy kings, having been put to death and hanged from trees, are thrown into a cave, the mouth of which is then covered with large stones. Absalom killed his brother, rebelled against his father. He's accursed, for he hanged upon a tree and was buried beneath the stone. In other words, he got what he deserved. It wasn't what he wanted. It wasn't certainly what David wanted. And yet he did get what he deserved. After the burial, we're told, all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now that Absalom has been killed, what's the point of fighting for him? They flee, they run away. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, in verse 18 says, had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and to this day it is called Absalom's monument. I have come across a tradition that says that this monument, or something very similar to it, is still there, and that Jewish people traditionally spit on the spot to show their distaste for the rebel son who would usurp the blessed King David. Now, that last section of the text does ask a few questions. One question is, where have we come across the erection of pillars before? Does it sound familiar? Well, yes, it does, because we have come across it before in 1 Samuel chapter 15. A king erects a monument to himself. The king was Saul. I put it to you that Absalom might be another generation, but he was another Saul. Saul reigned over Israel, certainly towards the end, without God's blessing. And Absalom would have reigned without it also. We have here another expression of his pride. Why does he erect a pillar? He wants to be remembered. Now, when we're first introduced to him in chapter 14, 27, we're told he had three sons. Evidently, they have died. Evidently, they are no more. Now, you might expect Absalom to have raised pillars to their memory. In fact, he raises a pillar to his own memory. I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. Well, dear Absalom, your name is still remembered. 3,000 years later, in a land far away, a land you've never heard of, we remember your name. Not as a fine example, but as a terrible warning of a man whose pride, ambition, lust for power prevented him from acknowledging and kneeling to God's appointed king. He had so much, and yet it wasn't enough. This chapter so far has been a tragedy. A good-looking, beautiful young man caught in a tree. He's killed, rather shamefully. 20,000 die. More die in the woodland, fighting in the dark, stumbling over sticks and bracken. an honest, faithful man in the army, is rebuked by a mercurial general. And yet it's also a chapter of justice. The so-called king who erected a pillar in his memory, his reign comes to an end. His very short reign comes to an end. And David is on the way back. I'm not going to look at any more text. I'll return to the narrative next Sunday morning. Friends, I see in this chapter, a warning to all of us. The false kings and rulers and powers to which we dedicate our lives, their time is coming to an end. The old king, the right king, the righteous king, Jesus Christ, is returning. Though he appears to have fewer men, though he cannot be seen on the battle, he is coming back to claim his throne. And every rebel king will be seized by the hair and cut down and buried under stones like one accursed. And yet the return of David is good news indeed. And the return of Christ is good news indeed. And I wonder if you're listening to this, what would you say to Jesus Christ, the returning King, if he were to come today? Would you rejoice to see him? Or would you flee every man to his own tent? The only question that matters is, what did you do with Jesus Christ? What did you do with him? Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Absalom fell, and so does everyone who opposes David. How much more they who oppose great David's greater son. May the Lord speak to your heart. Amen.